I'm John Kroll. Today, in this special recorded No Limits, we're going to have a conversation about urban green spaces and urban biodiversity. We're going to talk about the importance of preserving nature even in the heart of the city. We're going to discuss what having these wild spaces in metropolitan areas does for us and how we can find more of them. My guest will be David Forsell, president of Keep Indianapolis Beautiful, and Maggie Gagline-Hanna, executive director of Fall Creek Gardens. Because this is a recorded show, we won't be taking calls or questions by email, Facebook, or Twitter, but we invite you to comment on the discussion online. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism and publisher of thestatehousefile.com, as well as your host. We are talking today about urban green spaces and urban biodiversity here in the special recorded version of No Limits. It means we won't be taking calls or getting messages via email or social media. We hope you will enjoy this conversation. My guests are David Forsell, who is the president of Keep Indianapolis Beautiful, and Maggie Gagline-Hanna, who is the executive director of Fall Creek Gardens. Both of you are veterans of the show, right? You've been here before. That's good, right? To have you back.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start a little bit and talk about how we define what is an urban green space. I mean, it's more than somebody's backyard, presumably. So I'll start with Maggie on that one.
You know, I think the generally held definition usually indicates public access. So a lot of times in a city, it's going to be a lot that is empty for whatever reason. It might have been residential originally, might have had a business of some kind. But for whatever reason, it's just sitting empty. And the people have an interest in their neighborhood of having that be a park or a garden or some place where they can get outside in an otherwise pretty paved environment and enjoy a little piece of nature.
David, how many of these spaces do we have in, say, the Indianapolis metropolitan area?
Oh, that's a really good question. I'm not sure of the total number, Maggie. Do you know of the urban gardens or small farms at this point? Last I checked, maybe 50.
I would say probably 50 or more. There's a good map available through the Office of Sustainability of Urban Gardens, and so that would probably be a good resource we can look up and share.
And Keep Indianapolis Beautiful has helped develop, in addition to that, about 30 over the past 8 or 9 years, pocket parks, which may or may not have food.
What is a pocket park? I'm sorry to interrupt.
That's great. So we would define pocket parks as places that have been vacant or neglected or underutilized, often one city lot, that neighbors care to reestablish as an asset in their community. And so we work really closely with neighborhoods in a very authentic community-led way to sort of say, what is it that this community needs? What is that space when you imagine it? What is it? What can it be? And so very often they can be reflective spaces. They can be play places. They can be gardens, any variety of things.
Is the amount, the number of these spaces, is it decreasing or increasing now here in the Indianapolis, central Indiana area?
Maggie. I would say increasing substantially.
Increasing because it's more of a priority than it's been in years past?
I think there's that, and I think there's a great opportunity because there are urban spaces available. You know, in some communities, the land is at a huge price. You know, you don't have a lot of community gardens where you have very little land going unused. But in some communities in the city, there is a lot of empty space. And so people look at this as an opportunity to bring a place for outdoor enjoyment for their community.
Where does the hunger for these spaces come from, David?
That's very interesting. I think the hunger comes from a sense of community, I think is clearly part of it. I would say that the other thing is generally where we end up helping neighbors develop pocket parks or gardens, it is based in some very basic needs. Very often neighbors are living in environments that are low in income and high in crime, lots of disinvestment. And so they, as we all do, need a sense of beauty, a sense of community. I believe, too, a connection to the earth in some way. And so I think it's very fundamental.
When you say a connection to the earth, how do you define that, a sense of a connection to the earth? I want to make sure we understand what you're saying.
Yeah, I think two things immediately come to mind that are very different things. I love what Maggie is up to at Fall Creek Gardens. And truly, that is getting in touch with the earth, digging, finding the earthworms, planting the vegetables, producing your food. And I think there's something quite primal, actually, that some of us tend to forget when we think about trees and urban tree canopy. We need trees. Mm-hmm. We need these trees in order for us to thrive and to survive. And so there are any variety of ways to do that. I think the last bit, you had early asked about how we define urban green space. Mm-hmm. I would broaden it to also include parks and greenways that are also publicly accessible. And I think there is just a natural tendency for people to tend to go to water and tend to be in natural beauty, even in the urban context. And the research indicates it's very important for urban people to have those opportunities.
We are talking about urban green space, urban biodiversity here on No Limits. This is a special pre-recorded show, so we won't be taking calls or getting your questions or comments via email or social media. We're talking with David Forsell, who's the president of Keep Indianapolis Beautiful, and Maggie Gagline Hannah, who's the executive director of Fall Creek Gardens. David, set you up there, Maggie, by talking about the projects you're doing. Could you talk a little bit about the work of Fall Creek Gardens, what the mission is?
Sure. Our mission is to basically support people in the city who'd like to grow a little food for themselves. Whatever resources they're lacking, we'd like to be able to fulfill their needs. So, for example, we host a community garden. We have about 30, 35 individuals and families in the neighborhood that come and use the garden space to grow food for themselves. That might be because they have their own home, but a very shady yard. It might be that they're an apartment dweller and just don't have the ability to get their hands in the soil. This is a neighborhood that doesn't have a large grocery store with a lot of fresh produce available. So it's addressing a need for access that is a problem.
So is it technically one of the food deserts that we talk about, or is it on the borderline of being?
I think on the borderline. I haven't checked whether the USDA has us listed as a food desert.
And a food desert, we probably ought to explain to listeners, is a place where people can't get necessarily nutritious food.
That right.
Within, what is it, 20 minutes, I think traveling.
And there's the ratio is between access to a full service sort of grocery store versus the nearby proximity of convenience stores and gas stations where all you can really access are very processed, packaged, high sugar calorie.
Yeah, if it's in foods. A wrapper and it has cream in the center of it, it's probably not nutritious.
I see young kids across the street from our garden walk through the garden to the gas station a couple blocks away and come back with a bag of chips and a pop. And I think, oh, why don't you stop just for a second? You know, we have some great cherry tomatoes that taste almost like candy at this time of year. You know, I'd love to have you snacking on that rather than.
So the people who participate in the garden there, do they have to pay for the space, or is it something that you all, how much?
We do a couple things. So if you want your own plot, there is a fee of $15 for the season, for the summer.
Okay.
And that helps us with water bill and supplies and things like that. And we also hope that it engenders a sense of ownership over your plot. So you come back in July when it's hot and do the weeding and the watering. But then we also have a teaching garden, and that's all volunteer run. So anyone who wants to come and help us out a little in the garden can take home some produce as a thank you. We donate a lot of that produce, about 50% from that garden, to the Mid-North Food Pantry, which is the local pantry in the neighborhood. You know, they also have a real need for fresh food because it's so much easier to collect a lot of cans and have it sit on a shelf and be stable over a long period. Not all food pantries have a lot of freezers and, refrigerators, and so they're just very limited. So we try and contribute to that larger food access question for the neighborhood in a couple ways. We also teach a lot of classes. So the idea is if you want to learn about this, come to us, and then you can go home and do it on your own as well.
Who are the people who participate?
We have a wide range. It's fun for me. I love getting the community gardeners together because it's people of all ages. We have some senior housing a few blocks away, and those are the folks that seem to come first thing in the morning a lot of times to beat the heat. I have a lot of families with little children. I have young professionals, people of all walks of life, and I think it's great. It's a reflection of the neighborhood, but it's also exciting for me to see people getting to know each other, building community in our garden. They might not meet each other otherwise, you know. But also to see that this is something that appeals to just about all ages, all backgrounds, an interest in getting outside, fresh food. I don't know, little ones, when they pull something out of the soil that they planted, you can get a little kid to try just about anything if they helped you grow it. So when we talk about, you know, health and nutrition, I think this is a great way to enter that conversation.
And what sort of things do they grow in the garden?
Oh, all
kinds.
When
you talk. Okay.
We have a lot of sunflowers right now. That's okay. Everything's blooming right now. It's so beautiful in the garden. But lots of tomatoes, lots of greens. We're big on squash and sweet potatoes this year, which is interesting. I had a neighbor last year who grew nothing but beets because she loves to can pickled beets. And she had shown me a picture of her pantry, and it looked like something that my grandma would have produced at the end of the summer. Just she feeds her family all year round from her gardening efforts. So it's fun.
David, you said a couple of minutes ago that the surveys show that this is important, that it's a quality of life. Make the case, you know, for urban green space, because obviously you're going to have in a what is a still a culture in which, you know, land to some degree is considered a commodity.
Mm-hmm.
Why is this the best use as opposed to putting up another strip mall? Mm. Or?
Well, you know, there KIB tends to think about its work in terms of delivering sort of a triple bottom line, and it does it through landscape interventions.
Mm-hmm.
Triple bottom line meaning environment, economy, and society. So the research strongly suggests the amazing impacts associated with green space in this way. We've already talked about at Fall Creek Gardens this sense of community and connection. University of Illinois has this college called the Laboratory for Landscape and Human Health. Fascinating work that they do. One of the things that struck me that got me so excited about our work was research that suggested that looked at Robert Taylor Homes, which no longer exist, mm-hmm. but they were high-rises in Chicago. They looked at one building and another building, demographics virtually the same. The only primary variable was one building was surrounded by broken blacktop and bare soil, and the other looked at had trees and green space surrounding it. Less property crime, less violent crime, less domestic abuse, all reported in that place that was surrounded by tree canopy and green space. And the researchers believe that it is essentially related to the relative reduction in anxiety that people feel mm-hmm. in a stressful context, and that green space provides a reduced anxiety and also invites people out to be under a canopy or to be in a beautiful place where people get to know each other. So you have this academic case that's very strong, and here's Maggie living it right here in the heart of Indianapolis. And I'm happy to go further into some of the social aspects and economic aspects,
too. Well, yeah,
too,
please.
Very
please,
strong.
Please do.
Yes. So on the economic side, green space provides tremendous value. So consumers prefer to be in places that are beautiful. This is a research bit out of University of Washington. If given the choice, consumers will choose to go and shop, will shop longer, and will even perceive the products as having higher value in those places that have trees and well-maintained landscapes. And so we talk about that from an economic standpoint. Another is that urban greening provides a tremendous vehicle for people who are young and seeking first jobs. We have a program called the Youth Tree Team where 80 young people get their first employment opportunities. And so the economic case is pretty strong too. And of course, you know, we've covered the social, we've covered the environment or the economic, but then of course there's the environmental. And I think in Indianapolis, some of our most significant stresses from an environmental standpoint are in air quality and in water quality. Mm-hmm. And urban green space can do amazing things in terms of reducing water pollution, capturing stormwater, which contributes to our combined sewer matter here in Indianapolis. And then from an air standpoint, of course, so many ways that carbon capture, soot capture, and more are green spaces are essential for cleaning the air in our cities.
We are talking about urban green spaces, urban biodiversity here on No Limits. My guests are David Forsell, president of Keep Indianapolis Beautiful, and Maggie Gagline-Hanna, executive director of Fall Creek Gardens. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today in this special pre-recorded version of No Limits about urban green spaces and urban biodiversity. My guests are David Forsell, who is the president of Keep Indianapolis Beautiful, and Maggie Gagline-Hanna, who is the executive director of Fall Creek Gardens. Again, this is a recorded show, so we're not taking calls or getting messages from email or through social media. Well, we were talking beforehand about the benefits, really, of this, and we sort of broke down the economic, the environmental, the social. There also are – you've got some examples, obviously, of ways that having space like this changes people's lives. We were just talking during the break about a note that you've got here, David. Can you read this and give us some context? Who sent this to you? And then, Maggie, I know you've got stories too, but I'd like for us to put this in a human context.
Yeah, that's essential. Mm-hmm. Right? The mm-hmm. human context is, of course, essential, mm-hmm. particularly in a city. Mm-hmm. And so Keep Indianapolis Beautiful plants trees. We plant a lot of trees with communities, about 4,000 or so a year. And we want to make sure that those trees live and provide generational impact. Generally, we try to work with neighborhood-based organizations and volunteers to care for those trees. Occasionally, there's such important opportunities to plant because of environmental function or plantable space that we'll do that anyway. Mm-hmm. And what we do is we hire young people to plant and tend trees 9 months out of the year. And the summer session just wound up what we do is, amongst many things with these young people, is we ask them just to reflect on their last summer day about what the work of planting and tending and earning an income has meant to them. This is a note that just crossed my desk literally a few hours ago. And this is what one young man said. He said, "My friends have a job. I don't. I have nothing but fun Monday through Thursday. Thanks for teaching me how to be me, how to care for the trees, and how to help my city. Hopefully I'll be back next year. This has been truly amazing." This is the kind of thing that when you have a tough day, you're like,
yeah, you want to frame that one and put it on the wall.
That's right. I just got to – right. Just keep that right in front of me.
Well, that introduces a new element here in that, these spaces – allow for, journeys of self-discovery, too. I mean, he's talking about improving the community, but also talking about finding out things about himself that he did not know either. And that reminds me of something, Maggie, that you were talking about earlier, about the way that the young ones react, for example, when they pull the first carrot out of the ground or something like that. I mean, can you talk about what that is like and what that does to their lives?
I was honored to be able to start a preschool garden several years ago, not too far away from Fall Creek Gardens. And so this was little ones. There's a lot of activity around school gardens, which I think is so wonderful, but a lot of times it's for older children. And so I was really excited to be a part of this. So I had these little 3-4-year-old children, and we designed a garden together and grew it over the summer. So it was kind of a summer project after school was done. And what was so wonderful for me was to watch them exploring. You know, we made sure that this was a garden that was designed for that age. So we had a spot that was just for digging all summer long. Nothing ever got planted because this is an instinct. Everybody loves to get in the dirt at that age. And we didn't want to have that be a no-no. You know, we wanted that to be encouraged. But it was there were so many opportunities. You know, I was able to develop a little bit of a curriculum, and it was exciting for me to explore along with them. When you can take one seed and grow a sunflower that is 15 feet tall and the flower head is the size of a dinner plate, you know, this is an amazing concept for a child to see happen in front of them. The other thing is it teaches patience. You know, nothing happens instantaneously in a garden. So you have to plant the seeds and then come back. And this is a huge thing to pull a carrot out of the ground and realize that's where carrots come from. You know, this is new stuff sometimes, especially for urban kids. I think for a lot of us now at this point, I have people who don't know that potatoes grow underground until they come to the garden and see that that's, you know, how that grows. And for me, I think if you can get little ones in particular with this garden outside, exploring and looking at nature as an exciting place to discover rather than a place where you might get stung by a bee or you might have thunder and lightning come up and have it be scary. I think if we can encourage this love for nature very young, that serves you really well throughout your life.
How widespread is that sense of disconnect from what is the natural world? I mean, as you were talking, I was flashing back some years when I used to volunteer at an urban elementary school. I'm not gonna name it. And a friend and I at the newspaper where I worked at the time would go up during the course of the week a couple of times and help organize the recess activities, the kids, because there were at that point no men in the school at all. And a lot of the kids didn't have men in their lives in any fashion. And I remember one of the things we did with some of the boys in the school was we arranged this field trip that we took them to the natatorium, you know, on IUPUI's campus. And this does lead to what we're talking about here. One of the things that was eye-opening to me was walking those kids in there, and one of the boys grabbed my sleeve, pulled it real hard, looked at me and said, "Is this a lake?" You know, a huge indoor chlorinated pool. Something with a roof over it. And I realized, oh boy, this kid has never seen a lake before. He has no concept, context here. Is there, David? You're nodding here. I sort of started directing the question toward Maggie, but it seems to be striking something with you. How widespread is that? I mean, how many of our young people really have absolutely no idea of how the way the world works in its most physical sense?
Yeah, it's very widespread. We were talking before our show began about an author named Richard Louv who writes about this disconnection between young people and people generally and nature. And we had the same experiences. I was talking about our youth tree team. One of the things we do is we take them out overnight on a camping trip. We get them out on White River. And I can tell you there are young people who've never had that experience or are quite frightened by that experience because it is so foreign. And it's very widespread. It's interesting, too, I think, another interesting bit is that, gratefully, there's really a strong movement to get children connected to nature again. And we're working with some schools now. Instead of the big, funky plastic pieces of equipment, instead, very simple, natural play spaces, children find amazing opportunities for discovery mm-hmm. and exercise and taking risks. Mm-hmm. And so it's something that there's a generation that seems to have lost some of those very basic connections, and there's a movement to try to get some of those back.
Maggie, is that part of what prompted the sort of preschool, the gardening
yes.
experience? Is mm-hmm. exactly that?
Absolutely. I mean, we've reached the tipping point several years ago where more people live in cities than they live in rural areas. And mm-hmm.
that's here on a farm belt state.
That's a yeah. huge change for us, you yeah. know, as humans. So I think what was just part of your life for older generations is not necessarily something that children in urban areas have access to. They may not have a car where someone can get in and drive out to the country and go camping for a weekend. So mm-hmm. in some of these neighborhoods, it's an economic thing as much as an interest thing. And I think with school garden, that was absolutely my motivation, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that so much of what we do at Fall Creek Gardens, I'm very passionate about. But underneath all of the food access and social justice parts of it, it's just a belief that we really miss out as humans if we don't – if we feel like we're needing to be enemies of nature or control nature or fear nature. And mm-hmm. it's exciting for me to
and that
see –
we're not part of nature.
Absolutely, which we are.
We
you
are
know.
Part of the food chain. Yeah. We don't like to think of it that way, but we are.
Nobody wants kids to have a lot of asthma, but – you know, you have to then take the next step and say horrible air pollution is a big piece of that. So, you know, we can't just mourn the outcomes and not look at some of the causes. And I think that these urban green spaces can be, you know, beautiful little jewels of green growing spots of nature for people that have a real hard time accessing them otherwise.
We are talking about urban green spaces and urban biodiversity here on No Limits. This is a special pre-recorded show, which means we aren't taking questions by phone or by email or through social media. My guests are David Forsell, who is the president of Keep Indianapolis Beautiful, and Maggie Gagline-Hannah, who's the executive director of Fall Creek Gardens. Well, David, you've got an event coming up where you're going to be talking about precisely some of these issues. Talk to me a little bit about what Going Native is.
Yeah, well, we Keep Indianapolis Beautiful, our mission is to work with diverse communities to create vibrant places that help people and nature thrive. So that last bit is that we want people and nature to thrive in this city. And we thought it would be a really neat idea to bring some really internationally renowned researchers to the city to focus on those two elements, the fact that urban greening helps people thrive and it helps nature thrive. So one of the researchers is very sexy in the worlds that we are, occupying. His name is Doug Tallamy. And what he's known for right now is a book called Bringing Nature Home. Mm-hmm. And, his research, he's out of Delaware, but basically suggests that the very web of life at this point is at risk. Mm-hmm. That in the United States, maybe only 3-5% of the land is not somehow directly impacted by human activity. And finally, that there's a tradition about status in our country that was about bringing exotic and interesting-looking plants to our home landscapes and to mm-hmm. our cities. Bush honeysuckle is one of those exotics mm-hmm. that everybody thought was a pretty neat idea, and now it's taken over our streams and isn't particularly good for nature. So he believes that how we landscape in our very backyard and how we think about our public and publicly accessible landscapes is absolutely crucial to the well-being of the bottom of the food chain. He's an entomologist, so he likes bugs mm-hmm. And talks about how important that is, frankly, to the whole web of life. And he does it in a very compelling way. The other researcher that we're bringing is a lady named Dr. Andrea Faber-Taylor. She's just driving over from Champaign at the University of Illinois. And there, she's part of this Human Health and Landscape Laboratory that I've mentioned. And she is very well known for her work about children and attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder. And the very strong research that she's done that indicates that getting children in nature ameliorates those symptoms and that children are able to better concentrate and have less symptomatic problems when they simply have regular access to nature. It's fascinating. And these are just two researchers of many that are making this case for how important it is for us to be connected in some way to natural.
Now, is this event – when is this event? When is
going
native?
So it's happening on August 18th.
Okay. So a couple
of
weeks away. Yeah,
yes.
A couple of weeks away. And is there a cost to attend?
No.
It's free?
We're happy to have some sponsors, Lily and also a group called Trees Forever, which is out of Iowa.
Okay.
And so they're helping pay the tab so we can invite the public.
So, and if people want to get information about where it is
yes.
Feel free to give them either a URL or a phone number.
Yes. So KIB is – the website is KIBI.org or the phone number is 264-7555.
Okay. Feel free to do that again. People don't drive around
sure,
with pens
yeah.
at the ready.
Sure. So, yeah. The phone number is 264-7555.
And the URL one more time.
KIBI.org.
And where will this be? Where are you holding
it? It's going to be at Central Library in the auditorium. So I encourage people to act if they want to come. We think we can accommodate 300 people, but seats are – I'm not just selling you something.
At a premium.
They're at a premium.
Especially since people aren't going to be selling tickets.
That's right.
Pretty much first come, first served.
That's right.
Okay. Well, I want to talk a little bit now. If we could, about, you know, we've established, I think, the importance and the impact it has on people. Why is there not more urban green space than there currently is? I mean, what are the obstacles? What are the challenges there? Maggie, I'll start with you.
I can speak from urban garden perspective. Again, sometimes in communities, land is of a high price, and so that weeds out people right off the bat. In other communities where there's a lot of land but a lot of other issues in the community, what you find sometimes is that you have gardeners that get together. People really are into this idea. They take an open space and turn it into this lovely garden, put a lot of work and time into it, and then suddenly that property becomes a lot more attractive for other development. So there is some issues. There are some things that have happened with a lot of urban gardens in other cities.
Yeah, sort of the unintended consequences.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I think that this is also something where it can be hard to put a concrete value in dollars on these benefits. You know them. You know, we all know how wonderful it is to walk under a tree on a hot day and catch some shade rather than standing on a hot sidewalk. Mm-hmm. But how do you put a dollar value on that? So then it becomes – you know, you have to state your case in terms that translate to people of a lot of different backgrounds and interests, and so that can be a challenge. I think that this is a growing trend. I'm amazed sometimes, having lived back in Indiana now for 13 years, how much all of this has taken on real movement in our city. So it's exciting for me to see. I mean, I feel like we are on a rise of all of this activity, and it's starting to bear fruit, which is really exciting to see.
Bear fruit?
I know, right? That was a horrible pun.
Picking up, same question to you, David. What are the primary obstacles?
I think Maggie touched on, I think, the biggest one, and that is not fully grasping the value of these spaces. And there was actually just a study that came out this week by the U.S. Forest Service, and what it essentially has found is that the ecological services, just in terms of mitigating air pollution in the United States, urban trees provide 7 billion, with a B, 7 billion $1 of services. So that's avoided cost associated with technologies to clean the air and the like. And we've not been very good at quantifying the ecological services that green spaces and trees provide. And gratefully, our industry and people in work like we are in are getting better and better at that.
At figuring out how to put a number on it and a value.
So yes.
And some of it, admittedly, you know, as Maggie said, the spiritual component almost. It's hard to quantify something like that. Well, you are listening to a special pre-recorded version of No Limits in which we are talking about urban green spaces and urban biodiversity. We're not taking calls. We're not getting email messages, or you can't reach us through social media. My guests are David Forsell, president of Keep Indianapolis Beautiful, and Maggie Gagline-Hanna, who is the executive director of Fall Creek Gardens. I am John Krall, and you're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about urban green spaces and urban biodiversity. This is a special recorded version of No Limits, which means we aren't taking calls or messages today. My guests are David Forsell, who is the president of Keep Indianapolis Beautiful, and Maggie Gagline-Hanna, the executive director of Fall Creek Gardens. Well, before the break, we were talking about what the obstacles are to creating more urban green space and creating more urban biodiversity. And some of it, what came across was the issue of quantification, as it were, to establishing value for all of this. Let's assume, though, that people have ways to do this in their, if it's not so much urban green space, if they want to add, you know, levels of either natural beauty or even a certain amount of wildness into their property, what are some good, common, easy ways that they could go about doing that, Maggie?
I think there are lots of easy-to-find lists online of what good native habitat plantings would be for your yard. Oftentimes, there might be you know, kind of a classic landscaping plant where there's a native version or a native counterpart that is going to not only give you the same visual aesthetic effect, but it's also going to provide food or shelter for wildlife. So we mentioned the honeysuckle earlier. You know, this used to be recommended by all the county extension offices, and this is a great landscaping plant. Well, now we're finding it's not native here. It's taking over. But there are native honeysuckles that would do well and provide, you know, beautiful flowers and fragrance, but also wouldn't overstep their bounds, and they would provide better habitat and food for, you know, cardinals and other songbirds in the neighborhood. So I think that there's a lot of good information that exists. Places like Keep Indianapolis Beautiful or INPAWS, the Indiana Native Plant and Wildflower Society, they can give you a quick list of great plants to use around your property.
Is it, I mean, something you mentioned there made me wonder if there isn't a certain amount of dissonance in this, in that you said there is a whole lot of information online that you can use, you know, that since part of your focus here really is to get people outside, to get them to unplug at some level, does that...
There are challenges to this on a lot of levels. You know, a lot of these plants don't just stay at 6 inches tall. So you also, you don't want to get in trouble with high weed violations or something along those lines when all you're trying to do is grow some wildflowers for butterflies in your yard. So, you know, you can have your yard certified as a natural habitat, which is a great step. You get a little sign that you can put out. So this is intentional. I'm planting all this beautiful stuff because I'm trying to attract wildlife to my yard. So that might be a good idea. You know, talk to your neighbors, too, if somebody wants to know what those, you know, why you're planting goldenrod, you know. Have a conversation and talk about it. I think once you see the beautiful blooms and all of the birds that love to come and eat the seeds, you know, this for me was just an observation in my yard. I noticed that sometimes if I let things grow a little, suddenly I had goldfinches all over these plants, you know, once they've set seed. So it's exciting, I think, if you – this is part of the whole thing. If you can get outside for a minute and soak it in and start paying attention to who's flying around in the trees in your yard, suddenly it's exciting then to try and improve – habitat for those little creatures.
David, give me some simple ways to bring some natural beauty into your life if you're in an urban setting.
Yeah, I think that native plants are just absolutely crucial. Maybe a water feature. The Indiana Wildlife Federation, I believe, is the one that has the program around certifying backyards for habitat, and they're a great resource. It's very interesting. I think native plants are the key. Native trees are the key. Doug Tallamy, this is another potential resource for people who wish to take this on. Mm-hmm. He goes across the United States and identifies those native plants, number one, that for hundreds of years that insects and butterflies and birds have been adapted to and will actually eat from, but also those that are most effective for the most species. It's a fascinating thing, and my lovely wife and I have Tallamized our backyard, and we're so excited.
And the man is going to be happy to know that he's been converted to a verb now.
That's right. I think plants and water and cover are the things that people can really do a lot of good with. I brought in a recent USA Today, and the headline is disturbing to me, that researchers really believe that we are sort of in this fifth or sixth sort of mass extinction period in our world. And there are simple things we all can do, little steps we can take to sustain life through how we garden and how we landscape.
What in terms of the bigger picture then, which is where are there things we should be doing as a community, as a society, culture, to either first preserve more of these urban green spaces, or even in some process, I guess you can't necessarily create them as much as you can just, you know, return things back to their natural state. Mm. The idea of creation, that may be a small semantic difference, but it's probably important to understand. Are there things we could or should be doing to create, provide more of these spaces? David?
Yeah, I think the first thing that comes to mind for me is what we've been doing along Fall Creek, not far at all from Fall Creek Gardens. We've been working with the local CDC. It's just an amazing group, and Eli Lilly and Company. And we've targeted Fall Creek from 38th Street on the north all the way down to the front door of Ivy Tech. And we, over the past 3 years, have been eliminating the invasive canopy that absolutely was choking out any views of the creek from the streets. And we are beginning now to restore that place with natives. Becky Dolan is a researcher at the Butler Center for Urban Ecology. Mm-hmm. And what we have found is that these smart people who do research have something called the Habitat Quality Index, and we're actually moving the needle. So we are quantitatively making an impact in how it is that we are reimagining the waterways. And so that's one example sort of at a public scale where public-private partnerships can make a difference if they're patient and have the resources to go in for the long haul. That's just one thing to do.
Maggie, your ideas on ways that perhaps in the bigger picture we could provide more of these spaces.
I think I was very intrigued to learn about a concept called wildlife corridors in urban areas not too many years ago. And I think that it's fun for me at Fall Creek Gardens to see us being a piece of one of these. And what the concept there is that, you know, we have Fall Creek and it's lined with greenery, and there is now a lot of it's been invasive, but there is habitat there for wildlife. Mm-hmm. However, if any of those little bees or bugs or birds or whoever tries to venture too far away from Fall Creek, they're in, you know, a very urbanized concrete area. So the concept of wildlife corridors is that if all of if people were kind of strategically creating these green spaces, you can make inroads into the urban landscape that can still sustain wildlife. So it's interesting for me at Fall Creek Gardens. When we first started gardening there, every once in a while you'd see an earthworm in the soil, you know. Mm-hmm. Every once in a while you would see a bee pollinating a plant. But we've been really conscious about planting native species that will attract more and give more habitat for those critters, because that helps our pollination rate in the garden. You know, we can't grow a garden without bees to pollinate. So we're just a couple blocks from Fall Creek. So I think if we were talking about this from a citywide perspective, the more people take the time and effort to plant some purple coneflowers or an oak tree or another native species that is a great host for all of these, you kind of start connecting the dots for a more diverse natural ecosystem, even in the midst of a city. And that's really the only way we're going to do this. We're not going to get the people out of the city and just make room for nature. So we have to find really good strategic ways to coexist.
But should it be more part of, sort of an urban reclamation strategy that in some of these areas, and I'm thinking, the example, say, of Theodore Roosevelt, who sort of kick-started the modern conservation movement by pretty much just saying, okay, we're going to take huge sections of land and say, okay, you're not going to develop this.
Yeah.
When we have certain parts of the city, the buildings there, being abandoned or whatever, instead of saying, okay, we're going to figure out some way to revitalize this and maybe get new businesses, just say, no, we're going to knock them down and see what grows there instead. Hmm. As a matter of public policy. David.
Yeah, there's always a tension, of course, in an urbanized context between economic growth and well-being and ecology. And so the notion of integration that Maggie speaks to is really important. I would say that there are some policies and are some ordinances that do support these things in Indianapolis.
Are there enough?
I think we can do a lot better.
Yeah. And how would we go about doing better?
Well, I think there's a great opportunity here right now, and I compliment the city. DMD is going through a variety of very significant community-wide planning efforts, mm-hmm. Everything from how it is that we do parking lots, mm-hmm. For instance, to how it is that we manage stormwater and the like. The list goes on and on. But there are great ways right now that the community can participate in some of these plans with an intent to do better on the sustainability issues. And I compliment the city because what is now being presented is much more progressive than where we'd been.
We are talking about urban green spaces and urban biodiversity in this special pre-recorded version of No Limits. We are not taking calls because this is a recorded show, or take an email or social media messages. My guests are David Forsell, who's the president of Keep Indianapolis Beautiful, and Maggie Gagline-Hanna, who is the executive director of Fall Creek Gardens. Maggie, do you agree with David that there are things we could be doing better to preserve these spaces? I'm struggling to find the verb there.
Sort
because
of modifying.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, so that
space.
That we have more of them.
I think that it's just becoming widely apparent that having green space nearby is a very attractive feature for a community. So mm-hmm. When we talk about attracting young professionals, I think it's fascinating how green space is just part of this conversation now. And I think I agree that we could certainly do more. But I agree. I think that we're on a good path. I think some of the rezoning work, Indy Rezone, I think that that's a real critical conversation that's going on right now that's going, a lot of that affects urban gardens, kind of the urban homesteading trend that we see where people are trying to be a little more self-sufficient on their little property in the city. All of those things support a larger sustainability and an emphasis on green space. And I think my hope is that the work that comes out of some of this citywide conversation makes it just a little easier for all of us to navigate to navigate. So, for instance, you know, if you want to have a wildflower garden, you know, it's nice if you can have a sign from the city that says this is a native planting site and here's why this is important, and see if you can identify the monarch butterfly caterpillars on this plant and understand the larger context that's important.
And by the way, you know, don't complain if your neighbor's letting things grow out here rather than keeping a, you know, a lawn that you could shoot pool on.
Right. So, yeah. Yes, there are some, you know, everybody has their preferences and what they think are beautiful yards. And I think that if we are creative and inclusive in that conversation as well, hopefully we can help people maybe explore other ideas for what is beautiful in your yard.
How much of this is though, an issue of education on just that? That kind of issue. I mean, I remember many, many years ago living in a neighborhood not far from Broad Ripple where we actually in a section in the back of the house were letting some things grow out, and the neighbors got very upset.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and these were the folks who, you know, the grass was never more than a quarter of an inch off the ground or anything like that. Trying, you know, it was almost as if we were speaking different languages at that point. How much of this is getting people to realize that not having a perfectly manicured lawn might actually, A, be better in terms of the environment, but B, also has its own beauty? David?
Yeah, I totally agree. In my neighborhood, we've gardened for wildlife, and so we don't use chemicals. And believe me, we've suffered from the mosquitoes this summer.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've, you know, sort of made a conscious choice related to that. I love the clover in my front yard. The bees and the butterflies love the clover. My neighbors maybe don't appreciate it quite as much as I do. It is about education. I have to admit that even just a few years ago, I thought that native plantings were some sort of quaint sort of preference or some sort of thing only for historic preservationists.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was awakened by Talamy and realized that the web of life is absolutely dependent upon a native landscape. I never understood that insects and birds and butterflies for hundreds of years have become conditioned to only eat certain plants. When those plants aren't available, populations suffer and we start having a breakdown. So education was about your question. That was huge for me.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask this since we're getting close to the end of the show here. If there is an unknown jewel, you know, an urban green space that people really ought to see and I'll tee it up for you, Maggie. You can go Fall Creek Gardens here right out of the gate. Go ahead.
Yes.
Tell people how
it's
to get
it's a shameless
there.
Plug.
Go ahead.
Well, we would love to have people come by Fall Creek Gardens, and we are located on Central Avenue just north of 30th Street. You know, there are a lot of interesting urban agriculture and garden projects throughout the city. So you don't have to even come just to Fall Creek Gardens to experience this. There are lots of places to visit, which is exciting. One that I think is a really unique space is Fruit Loop Acres, which is on the Near East Side, because it's a forest garden. So these are tall trees and they are still producing lots of fruit and produce from you know, it looks like a wooded lot. So I think there's a lot of great examples in our city.
David, I think is the last word here. Going native, how do people find more information about
yes.
your event?
Visit kibi.org. We'd love to have people come and register and see some of this profound research that is absolutely fundamental and foundational for the work that Maggie and I do.
And I think that will have to be the last word. I would like to thank both David Forsell, president of Keep Indianapolis Beautiful, and Maggie Gagline-Hanna, the executive director of Fall Creek Gardens, for this enlightening conversation. I've enjoyed talking with both of you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
And I would like also to thank our listeners. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. technical producer Cedric Freeman, and board engineer Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.